Thanks for downloading the Milt Rosenberg podcast. Since Milt left his radio show last year, we've heard from hundreds of listeners who want to access Milt's old archive shows. As some of you may know, we're launching this new feature at miltrosenberg.com, where we're posting shows from Milt's 40-year radio career, with guests including Saul Bellow, Charlton Heston, David Brinkley, Stephen Ambrose, Robert Gates, Richard Brookhiser, and that's just a start. There are currently dozens of old programs posted, and over the course of the next few months, we expect to have hundreds of classic Milt Rosenberg shows found at miltrosenberg.com. So head over to miltrosenberg.com and take a listen. Thanks for listening, and now here's the show.
And hello, this is Milt Rosenberg with another in the podcast series. As I said recently, while introducing yet another podcast, there are sort of two ways to do this. It depends upon whether I know or know well the person I'm talking with, or whether he or she is just a distant person of interest by virtue of his or her expertise, academic credentials, political history, or what have you. My guest today is one of my best friends around the University of Chicago, Charles Lipson, who is a leading political scientist and one of the most popular people on campus with the students, if not with the administration. Charles, that's a fair representation of your position, is it not?
I think so. I have really large classes, and I must say that I love working with the students as much as I hope they love working with me.
Well, they've given you the Quantrell Prize, which is the annual prize for undergraduate excellence, for excellence in undergraduate teaching. But when I mentioned the administration, you've had some outs with them in recent years. What has that been about?
Well, the main one has been that I've opposed the Obama Library coming to campus. I've had many good things to say about other things that our administration has done. I think we've done a beautiful job of recruiting students. The campus is now gorgeous. The university's intellectual vibrance is as great as ever. So I have many good things to say, but I don't think that the Obama Library should come to campus.
Now, is the university strongly competing for it, bidding for it, looking forward to it?
They seem to be, but they don't really tell we mere faculty about that. I actually favor the university, the city of Chicago recruiting the library. I think it'd be a good thing for the city. I think it's fine if the university honors a sitting president, even one I have major disagreements with. They honor him because of his association with the university. You normally do that with a name of a building or scholarships or a professorship. But I think that the problem with the library is not the library itself, but the permanent think tank to support what he thinks is good public policy. And whether or not I think it's good public policy is irrelevant. The problem is we shouldn't have partisan political agendas like that on campus.
Well, now, you know, it's very interesting in your department, or somehow affiliated with your department, though I guess it's listed as a separate institution, is a think tank partly funded by and run by David Axelrod, the man who gave us Barack Obama as president.
Well, first of all, I should say that I've known David for many years, but I had to.
So have we all.
I have had the same concerns when that was first announced, and at the very beginning of it, I explained both to David and to the administration that I thought that it would only be acceptable if it was equally open to a variety of political presentations, and if the internships our students got could as easily happen with somebody on the left or on the right. And I'm happy to say that at least so far, the Institute of Politics associated with David Axelrod has worked beautifully in that regard. They have been, it's a place where young Republicans as well as young Democrats meet. It's a place where students can get internships in Republican offices as well as Democratic offices. Their fellows that they've invited in have been even-handed. But that wouldn't be the purpose of an Obama institution. An Obama library would be set up with a museum and think tank to celebrate his presidency. That's its purpose. That's not the purpose of the Institute of Politics. And if it veered off into that kind of a purpose, I would oppose it too.
So there's nothing to the rumor I've heard that they are thinking if they establish or when they establish the Obama Presidential Library in Chicago to show that they are open to all possibilities. They're going to offer you the curatorship of the library.
No. I think that there's as much chance of that as having the blue dress displayed in the Clinton Library.
Yes, that was really an invention of the moment on my part. Let's talk about some of your interests. They are very broad and wide, both as an activist, an activist on the conservative side,
right,
with regard to certain important issues that preoccupy the country. But let's talk about your work as a political scientist. Going to one of your major interests, and it's by no means the only one, but it's well established in a very important book of yours, published about 10 years ago now, titled, yeah, Separate Peace. This is a book which asserts the thesis that democracies don't go to war with one another.
That's right. There's an old academic joke, Milt, that says, we know that it works in practice. Now we've got to see if it works in theory.
Yes.
My book is, in effect, an exploration of something that we know works in practice, namely that well-established democracies fight lots of wars but don't fight wars with each other, and to try to explain why that might be happening. The book is called Reliable Partners: How Democracies Have Forged a Separate Peace.
Let me test you on this, going way, way back. You would agree and allow that we could classify Periclean Athens as a democracy of sorts?
Yes, lawyer. Yes, my lawyer Rosenberg.
All right. Now, in the Spartan League that fought the Peloponnesian War against Athens and its league states, surely there were some other democracies in the ancient Greek style, were there not? I know that Sparta was not. But weren't some of the others? Wasn't Thebes essentially organized on democratic lines?
This is actually an interesting methodological question. Most of the studies of democracies not fighting wars with each other are done post-Napoleonic Wars, that is, post-1815. I'm actually interested in the ancient Mediterranean world, and I'm doing some work actually on ancient Greece right now related to a different project. But the methodological question asks you, how do you classify wars in which the main protagonists are of one sort or another, but some of the smaller allies on one side fight against allies on the other side? So in World War II, if Japan, Italy, and Germany had any democratic allies, and at one point Finland, which was a democracy, was on their side and ended up fighting against the large coalition on our side, which included, of course, the Soviet Union, a non-democracy. How do you classify all of those? I'll leave aside those complicated arguments. The basic point is, nevertheless, the big exception to the rule about democracies not fighting other democracies has to do with young and unstable democracies. So take something. First of all, how do you classify something like Morsi's Egypt shortly after the election? It was an election. They elected this anti-liberal government of Mohamed Morsi, but it wasn't a stable democracy. If it had gone to war with a real democracy, Israel, for example, would you have said that that's a war between democracies? Yes, it would have been a war between democracies at that point, but it wouldn't have been stable democracies. So, but the question is, how do you look at these topics? And I just find them fascinating, I must say.
Well, that is a very interesting topic. Your mention of Israel, and for that matter of Egypt, leads me inevitably, and by desire as well, to the Middle East, and particularly right now to some of the troubles that are roiling there. Let me just point to a few of them and get your response and your thoughts.
Sure.
One is the triad of Israel, Iran, and the United States. And our recent dealing with Iran, which seems, I don't know how to interpret it, some interpret it as giving them the go-ahead to develop their nuclear weapon, but slowly, please, more slowly. Others say, no, we've really blocked them from doing so. Israel clearly doesn't think that Iran is blocked from a full military nuclearization and still is muttering, are they still taken seriously in this, I wonder? These are all questions for you to address in a moment. Is still muttering, we may have to undertake this ourselves. We are not dependent upon the United States for a solution to the Iran problem. Maybe we'll use, if not our nukes, at least our bomber force. And indeed, there was recently some sort of trip of Israeli military, I gather, down into Saudi Arabia, examining some base operations, looking toward, it has been suggested by journalists, to Israel basing its planes in Saudi Arabia before they fly off to destroy nuclear installations in Iran. I've undoubtedly activated 100 different ideas. Give me 3 or 4 of them.
Well, the first thing is, how do you evaluate this temporary, you might call it a truce rather than a peace, between the United States and Iran? And I think that the optimists say it gives us breathing room to settle something that's more permanent. The pessimists, and I lean more toward the pessimistic side, but I'm not on this issue, but I'm not certain about it, is that Iran basically got what it wanted, which was it got it didn't have to remove anything that it had enriched. It didn't have to remove any of its centrifuges. Some of the enriched materials had to be diluted, but they can easily be reconstituted. So I don't see them having to give up much. Let me step back one. I think that they are deeply committed to moving toward at least the edge of having a nuclear weapon. And I think only one thing short of war would stop them from doing that, and that is that they fear that their regime would collapse because of economic sanctions. And I think that what we've given them then, by relieving many of the sanctions and in effect promising to relieve more without a complete and full settlement, is the real opportunity to accomplish their main goal, which is to continue toward a nuclear weapon without having to fear that the economy will collapse their regime. That's the danger.
Go to Jerusalem, or more properly to Tel Aviv, where the government really is based, and tell me about the Israeli attitude and about the Israeli predicament.
Well, I think that the Israelis and Saudis, you mentioned the Saudis earlier, are both petrified by this agreement.
Yeah.
Because they see a weak United States that can't negotiate from a position of strength. Indeed, I think the whole world does see that.
And is it in fact the case, as I was suggesting, that Israel and Saudi Arabia are presently cooperating in an anti-Iran operation?
This actually brings me to the work that I'm doing right now. I think most international relations scholars actually look at states as being the main actors. I believe states are controlled by domestic regimes. And I think that the problem, if it was just an external threat faced by the Saudis and the Israelis, they would readily cooperate. The problem the Saudis have is that they're not only threatened from the outside by the Israelis. If they were to cooperate with the Israelis, they would face severe internal threats because they've spent their entire career revving up the most extreme and anti-Semitic forms of Islam. So if they were to cooperate with the Jewish state, they would really face internal problems. So they face a common external problem, but the Saudis, I don't think the Israeli public would have any difficulty basing planes in Saudi Arabia. But remember, Al-Qaeda claimed that the basing of U.S. forces in Saudi Arabia was one of the things that led them to attack the U.S., the United States.
But were the news reports true, or were these false rumors that there has been some interaction between Israeli representatives and Saudi representatives on the ground in Saudi Arabia looking at basing possibilities?
I don't know whether the reports are true. I would expect they are, but it's a long way from looking at those possibilities to actually bringing Israeli planes in, basing them in Saudi Arabia, and you wouldn't base them there permanently. What you would do is you'd move them there, you'd refuel them.
Oh yeah,
and
sure.
Then you'd move into an attack on Iran. But I think that one of the big problems that the Israelis see with the agreement that the United States has struck with Iran is that it boxes them in, because they don't want to be in the position of bombing Iran while there are potentially fruitful, in quotes, negotiations going on with the United States, the permanent five plus Germany.
But when Netanyahu and his colleagues still continue to say, we hold all options open and available, we are making our own policy with regard to Iran, and we are not dependent upon the United States for a final solution to these problems. Are they speaking their hearts and their intentions, or is that political rhetoric to disguise their own essential, at the moment, passivity or enforced passivity, as it were?
They're caught in a very difficult bind for several reasons. The essential feature of Israel from its very foundation is that in the aftermath of the Holocaust, Jews don't depend, especially in a Jewish state, Jews don't depend on others to defend their vital interests. That's what Israel is based on. On the other hand, the Israeli senior leadership and military leadership is deeply divided on whether an attack on Iran would work or be a good idea. It comes with huge risks and huge costs. And those huge risks and huge costs have now been substantially added to by the United States taking basically a negotiation from weakness approach with the Iranians, because any attack on Iran now would run counter to what the United States is doing, and the United States is the only serious ally right now of the Israelis.
You know, that radio program that I did for many years, on which you appeared very frequently, also hosted about the last four or five American secretaries of state. I did not do a program with John Kerry. Mm-hmm. However, I was on a platform with him a long, long time ago, mm-hmm. when I was a little bit more leftish than I presently am, and did a book, about the Vietnam War, critical of the Vietnam War, and there was a special rally of people of that sort held at Yale University, which I had only recently left to go elsewhere academically, but I was invited back for that. And on the rostrum were six or seven people who had something to say about the Vietnam War, and one of them was a guy with whose most impressive feature was a very large leonine mane of still quite black hair, or at least brown hair, and he, it turns out, was a veteran of the Vietnam War, where he had commanded something like a PT boat on the rivers of that country, and he was enthusiastically contemptuous of the American government for any kind of foreign adventures, when it should really just look to the prospects of and the problems and dilemmas of the poor and the black and so on in the United States. That was, of course, as you've anticipated by now, Kerry, before he entered public life, though he was already in public life on the streets of Washington, throwing his draft card, as I remember it, over the fence at the White House. What do you make of John Kerry as Secretary of State of the United States?
I think that John Kerry is actually very well informed about foreign policy issues. We've had a lot of secretaries of state who've been well informed, Condoleezza Rice, for example, Colin Powell, and of course going back to the truly great secretaries of state like Dean Acheson and George C. Marshall. But we've also had secretaries of state who had to sort of learn a foreign policy on the job, like Hillary Clinton. Kerry is well informed, but I think Kerry's general views tend toward a kind of European, can't we all get along, let's negotiate. And frankly, I just don't think he's the kind of person who is a great negotiator. I haven't seen it. I don't think the president's a great negotiator. Myself, domestically, we haven't seen any negotiations that really panned out where he cut a deal that involved people who had opposing views and so forth. He's generally farmed that out. I think that they made some serious mistakes in dealing with Iran. I think they've made serious mistakes in other areas as well, but in Egypt as well. But I think that it sort of remains to be seen at this point.
To me, one of the rather more distressing appointments by the president as bearing upon foreign policy was Samantha Power to the UN as our representative there. Again, that's somebody that I got to know a bit when she appeared on the radio program and when I read her various books. She has, I think one has to say, a rather critical view of Israel and its operations, and very much a let's reconcile with the Arab states orientation. And indeed, she worked in the Obama senatorial office for a number of years, having left her sort of in-house journalist appointment at Harvard to come down there and supply him with foreign policy ideas or information. I think she's been a very strong influence. I estimate she may well have been a very strong influence on shaping Obama's views on the Middle East. And I'm not too happy about that.
Well, I think that the view on the American left is generally that a close relationship with Israel is an impediment to U.S. foreign policy. And I think that she, Susan Rice, John Forbes Kerry, and others sort of hold that as a kind of background understanding. When Obama began his presidency with a trip to Egypt, skipped over going to Israel, made an outreach to the Arab world, was really designed, like his policy in Russia, as a reset. I think the question took some steps toward Israel that the Israeli public and most Americans who were pro-Israel felt were very negative, demanding a pause in settlements and so forth, which the as a precondition, in effect, for negotiations. The PLO had not even done that. The Palestinian Authority had not even done that. That, of course, froze everything for a year to no good effect. I think what happened in the aftermath of that was that there was nothing fruitful that came out of that in terms of U.S. relations with the Arab world, but it weakened U.S. relations with Israel. I think the question is, did they learn anything from that? I have no indication that they did.
One of the most interesting scenes I've ever observed on television was a few years ago now, after a Netanyahu visit to the White House, and he and the president had their private meetings and then came to sit before the cameras to give a post-meeting press conference. And as I know you will remember, Obama said whatever he thought to be more or less appropriate, and there was no particular offense or challenge in it. And then it turned to Netanyahu, and he spent 15 minutes essentially giving the president and the country a lesson in Israel's concerns about us, their concerns about their untrustworthy neighbors, and their intention to stand strong despite possible American non-cooperation. It was a kind of an embarrassment for the president for Netanyahu to be essentially delivering a kind of ultimatum virtually to the American government in the White House before millions watching on television. You remember the occasion, don't you?
Oh, I remember it well. I thought it was the low point in U.S.-Israeli relations of the Obama administration before the recent deal with Iran. I thought it was a mistake by Netanyahu. I don't think it was a mistake to say those things in private, but I think showing up the president in public like that did not help the cause of U.S.-Israeli amicable relations. Clearly, however, he was deeply peeved. They had been brought into the White House through a side door, walked out past garbage on the side. They had not,
and that was the day they wouldn't give them lunch either, I think.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was just amateurish diplomacy, I thought, on the White House side. But I thought it was, granted, it showed real toughness on Netanyahu's side. But who doubted that?
Before we abandon Israel, that's before we leave it, we are not abandoning it, but there is a question of whether the world and history will ultimately abandon Israel. You're staunchly pro-Israel and concerned with their welfare and their future, as am I, as you well know. But you're also given to the longer view at times. Take the longer view. At the end of the century into which we're just now launched by a little bit more than one decade, will Israel still be there, and what will it be?
I think that there are two longer-term risks to Israel. One is the increasing lethality and extremism of their enemies. So they've always had lethal enemies, the kind of people who captured Israeli athletes in Munich and killed them. But when those groups are armed with nuclear weapons or biological weapons and so forth, those pose real dangers. I would say on the happy side of that, Israel's war with Hezbollah, which was a few years ago, which was widely viewed as a defeat for Israel, has proved over the medium term not to be a defeat. You've noticed that during all the Arab Spring and Israel's incursion into Gaza and so forth, Hezbollah did nothing. They did nothing to attack Israel. So it may be that the big question there then, in other words, is can Israel deter these very lethal opponents? And of course, the big issue there is, will the Middle East just become suffused with nuclear weapons? That's one of the dangers of Iran going nuclear, that a lot of other countries will then go nuclear, and that's just a very dangerous environment. The second big issue has to do with the demographics of non-Jewish populations within Israel, which is a democratic state that accords rights to everyone, but which intends to be both democratic and Jewish. And over the longer term, that's a big and important issue, too. That's the reason the Israelis would like to have a separate Palestinian state, if they can only find one with which they can make a stable peace.
Another consideration, though, is that even if you don't get a hostile Palestinian state functioning as a truly separate entity, the demographic picture in Israel itself, given the different birth rates between the Jewish and Arab sectors of the population, may ultimately produce an Arab majority in, say, 20, 30, or 50 years. And if there were an Arab majority, what would the further consequences be for the continued Jewishness of Israel, or let alone the continued integrity of Israel as a separate democratic state?
Yes, those are long-term issues. My general sense about that is that that Jewish birth rates have actually gone up, probably because of the Hasidim, and Arab birth rates have gone down, probably because of more economic development in the West Bank and so forth. It's really hard to look at those down the line. But the bigger issue is not whether or not – I mean, there is a big issue if Israel were to become a non-Jewish majority. But I think the issue there really is that Israel doesn't want to have within its territory non-Jews who don't want to be there. There are a number of Israeli Arabs who actually want to be within Israel, are good citizens of Israel. But to the extent that there are Palestinians who want to have their own separate state, it's in their interest and it's in Israel's interest to be able to figure out a way that they can have their own state, but one that can live in peace with its neighbors. And right now, when you look around the Middle East, you can't be particularly optimistic about these states being stable and able to live in peace, even inside their own borders.
You know, in passing, I must note what you just said about the Hasidim and their birth rate in Israel brings to mind the recent Pew study of American Jewry and the finding there that the non-Orthodox Jews are in declining birth rate, indeed are below replacement level. It's now about 1.8 for non-Orthodox Jews, but the Orthodox Jews, including, of course, the Hasidim, have a much higher birth rate, suggesting that it may be the ultimate reality in all historic change over the mid-range or long course is demographic reality.
Well, it could be. It's also the case that over the medium to longer term, there's been a falling away from Judaism of some groups within the Jewish community.
Well, a further Pew finding, of course, was that we always knew that in recent years, some 50% of all Jews who marry non-Jews. If you discount take the Orthodox out of the picture. They all marry other Orthodox Jews, basically. It's closer to 70% of non-Orthodox Jews are these days marrying non-Jews.
And that's what you would
expect. In America, that is.
That's
in
right.
America.
And that's what you would expect. They go to Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Stanford, University of Illinois, the University of California, Los Angeles, or whatever. And they meet.
Why don't you mention the University of Chicago?
And they go here, too. And they meet classmates just like everybody else. And then they get married. And if marrying someone of the same faith, whether they themselves are Jewish or whether they are Catholic or whatever, is not their highest priority, then they just pair up. And what happens, we find, I think, is that the next generation, especially in these cross-religious marriages, and the parents being relatively secular to begin with, is that the children are just raised without any religion at all, and that causes a falling away. There's a second issue, which is that people who are Jewish identify less over time with Israel than before, but we've also found that people who are more conservative or more Orthodox, conservative form of Judaism or Orthodox, and go more regularly to synagogue, have a stronger association with Israel. These are longer-term trends, and it's hard to know which way they'll move. But they, I think in the end, the United States' relationship with Israel does not depend heavily on the, quote, Israel lobby. It depends upon how the United States sees its basic national interest in the Middle East and how Israel sees its national interests in the Middle East. If those are coincident, they form policies that are strongly reinforcing. And if they see their interests differently, as the Obama administration sees our interests differently from the Netanyahu administration, then those policies will diverge.
When you mention the Israel lobby, I think you're actually using a term which is the title of a book by one of your colleagues.
Yes. I think that...
Do you want to open that can?
It doesn't matter to me. I mean, John Mearsheimer's book on the Israel lobby is, of course, a very prominent book. I think that it's accurate to say that that there is an active, organized lobbying group for Israel in Washington, APAC, the American Israeli Public Affairs Committee. It's not actually a PAC, but I mean it's an active lobbying group. And then, but I think that that is not the source of most pro-Israel feelings or policies. The main reason the United States has a lot of pro-Israel policies is not only that it's in our interest, but that if you ask the general American public which countries they admire and like, they admire most Canada, and right after that it's England and Israel. And this is not something among Jews or even just among evangelical Christians, who are a very strong support group for Israel. It's a general view that they're a beleaguered democracy trying to do their best in the face of terrorism and surrounding neighbors that hate them and want to wipe them out.
But it is the argument that Mearsheimer develops, Mearsheimer and his co-author in that book, as they did earlier in a major article, the Israeli lobby predominates in influence over American foreign policy, and influence very often which runs against a true American national interest. This view has been picked up by the Arab world, and and they are much quoted, indeed invited to come and talk about all of this. In general, this has been a burden, I should think, upon the political science profession in this country, or am I wrong in that, since many in political science are quite leftist these days, and their leftism also does include, apart from the usual leftist positions, some condescension toward or distrust of Israel?
I think that the left is increasingly distrustful of not just Israel, but American power and all the rest. You know, when we were kids, Milt, people used to say, might doesn't make right. I would say that it's a general view on the left in America that might makes wrong. I think Israel, one of Israel's great crimes is that they've been successful and that they're strong, at least strong relative to the Palestinians. And I think that the general view on the left is that people who are weak or people who are impoverished are always the victims. They can't really do much that's wrong. So you have people, and I see it at political science conventions, so you have, you would think that feminists, for example, would be really strongly opposed to the oppression of women throughout the Muslim world, especially in the Middle East. They tend not to say much about it. They're kind of embarrassed a little bit about it. They like to talk about movements of rebellion and opposition, but they think of that mostly with respect to the United States and so forth. And I've just listened to too many of these things to hold out much hope of that. Fortunately, students don't agree with that.
We could extend a little bit and do a kind of a tour of the horizon, looking at some other major nations with whom we have at least ambivalent relationship. Particularly what I have in mind are the two former communist nations, one being the Russian Federation, the major remnant of the Soviet Union. The other being, of course, China, which still officially defines itself as communist, but it's a communism so transformed and so capitalistically inclined in its economic development that one can't really take it as a serious Marxist-Leninist enterprise. I'm just opening our discussion to whatever you've got to say about the rise of China and China in our future, and for that matter, our strange relationship with Russia, or is it our strange relationship with Putin? I don't know, but I'd love to hear what you've got to say about that.
Let me take Russia first. I think that the Russia reset, as it was called under Hillary Clinton, but under the direction of Barack Obama, was a total failure. That is, the idea was that our relations had become increasingly vexed during the George W. Bush administration, that with the power of the personality and a kind of more congenial foreign policy, President Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton could reshape our relations there. And in the process, they not only stuck out a friendly hand, they basically withdrew a fair amount of our support from Poland and other allies in Central Europe. The Russians read that largely as weakness. But you must remember that Putin's regime is really a league of thieves and thugs. It's a kleptocracy. And it's in no ways democratic. If you protest against them as a band did or as journalists do, they're put in jail or they just disappear. They die.
I must take this moment, Charles, yeah, to say to the Ricochet audience prior to this program, which at the time that they are hearing it, we did put up on our location. At Ricochet, we did put up a full discussion with David Satter, who's been with us once before. David Satter has been a journalist in Moscow on and off for many years. He is happily and incidentally a former editor of the Chicago Maroon, the undergraduate newspaper at the University of Chicago. And Satter has specialized in the analysis of how Russia became, as the Soviet Union dissembled, or rather disassembled itself, how the Russian Federation became, quote, a kleptocracy. He and I discussed that in the podcast available just a few spaces down on this, the very site that people are at right now if they're listening to this interview via the Ricochet site. But back to what you were saying about then the kleptocratic Russian state.
And look at what's happened just recently in Ukraine, where in effect the Russians reached out. Ukraine was trying to form stronger relationship with the EU,
yeah,
and Putin reached out and just slapped them down. And did you hear a peep out of Washington? No.
No, you heard a peep. You heard a peep. You heard screams of pain and rage on the streets of Kiev.
Exactly.
From the population.
Exactly. But in other words, the United States is in effect unilaterally drawn down its position there. You could say that the one area where there has been increased cooperation between the U.S. and Russia has been Syria, because that's an area where we, in effect, gave Putin the green light. We were on the opposite side. They were supporting the Assad family and the Alawites in their suppression of this movement. The United States very publicly drew a red line, and then President Obama had not thought the next step down the road, which is what happens, I wonder, if they cross the red line, am I prepared to do anything? And it turns out he wasn't. And so he should have never – if you're not prepared to follow through on the threat, you don't make the threat in the first place. And in fact
– Well, I think that red line followed a strange transformation procedure. The red turned to pink, the pink turned to yellow.
Exactly. And then the yellow turned to the power is out on that stoplight. I didn't favor them going in and doing anything at that point. They had already blown it so thoroughly. At this point within Syria, it's hard to know what you'd like to see as an outcome. I mean, both sides just look terrible. Let's turn to China, Milt.
Please.
My sense is that the Chinese have been overplaying their hand. They've been growing so rapidly for such a long time and putting so much money into their military that their military has been getting much stronger. And with it, China's willingness to sort of swagger into international disputes, in particular into the South China Sea. As China has done that, and most recently done it by putting forward a kind of, in effect, a no-fly without asking us first zone that conflicts with the Japanese zone that covers some of the same barren islands, They did that, I think, the Chinese did that, without thinking through what the effects would be. And what the effects are, the first and main effect, is to make the whole area more dangerous, subject to the potential shooting down of a plane or something bad happening. In fact, we've told U.S. commercial airliners not to fly through that area. We told them that after the Japanese had told their airliners to fly through, so we, in effect, undercut the Japanese. But the main effect of China appearing to be a swaggering, fearful, a fear-inducing country is that all the countries in that region are now looking to the United States for counter-Chinese leadership.
Are the Chinese properly launched on a long future in which the present Communist Party elite remains in power and the Chinese population basically finds life bearable and acceptable? Or is there a crisis to come?
Nobody knows. Honestly, nobody knows. The news reports, for example, on basically everything depends upon China continuing a very strong growth path, because as Samuel Huntington told us long ago, when you begin to grow and move people into the cities, it doesn't just relieve some pressures, it actually increases some pressures on the government. It increases them because people think, why not me? I'm still living out in the fields. Why can't I move into Shanghai and get a job? And if those jobs don't grow rapidly, then there'll be a problem. There are a lot of other problems. There are pollution and other kinds of things. So I think, and we just don't know, and there's a lot of corruption in the system. So we just don't know. So far, it's managed it all very well. You just don't know how well they'll be able to manage it into the future. And they've, one of the ways that they've sort of built up support is by revving up huge nationalism, most of which is anti-Japanese, and that's also a source of real concern. It reminds people of Germany before World War I.
You know, it suddenly occurs to me, you probably these days have exposure to a number of young Chinese citizens. When I speak of young Chinese citizens, what I have in mind, of course, is the fact that American universities and the major universities, including University of Chicago, have been flooded with Chinese students. Apparently, many of them not quite appropriate for admission to the elite universities of China, and thus sent to the United States by their fairly well-to-do parents who are paying the tuition. Have you talked with young Chinese lately at the university?
I talk with them all the time. There are a lot of Chinese students here, and they are very good. They are very good. One of the great strengths of the United States is that we recruit students from all over the world, and many of these are the best students. There was some suggestion there that some of these students may not be the best. That may be true at some non-elite universities, but if you were to look at Stanford or Chicago or the University of Illinois or the University of Michigan, what we get are really great students. I'm sure that that's true of all the top universities around the United States. The problem is that students who've been educated elsewhere, and this could be Turkey or Germany or South Korea, when they come into the United States, they are entering a very different university system where we like to have students express their views. They don't have to agree with a professor. And many of them come in thinking that it's rude to disagree with a professor, that they're doing the wrong thing if they don't sort of repeat exactly what the professor says. So there's a second issue when you talk with students who come from non-democratic states or states where you could be cracked down for having the wrong opinion. They may feel that there's a reason for them not to say what they truly think, and that's because they can't be sure that some of their fellow students aren't spies.
We've arrived back at the university situation. I wanted to ask you, and this will, I guess, well, since we're close to using up all of the available time, will be my last major probe. But I know that you're very concerned about the state of the American university, including your own, and as it happens, my own university, namely the University of Chicago. And I know that one of your main concerns is the leftism, which tends to predominate in the social science and increasingly in the humanities departments. There are so many questions one could raise about that. The first and persisting one is, how did it get to be the case? It wasn't the case when I was an undergraduate 1,000 years ago, probably not even when you were an undergraduate.
I think that there are two things that are driving it among the faculty. First, our listeners should know that the views of the faculty are not necessarily the views of the students, but the faculty is, in the humanities especially, is very far to the left, and the faculty in the social sciences, depending upon the field, is generally pretty far to the left. That is, you cannot find any anthropologist anywhere who likes globalization or trade. If you were to say capitalism good or bad in the sociology department or anthropology department or soft areas of the social sciences, generally you would find a lot of opposition. But
you would find that even in political science departments, would you not?
Absolutely. So what explains this? I would say that aside from the sort of 1960s baby boomer generation being in the professorship, there are two other things. One is that there's been a general movement on the left from being an anti-communist left in the 1950s to being a social democratic left. You can see that in basically all of President Obama's policies and appointments to the bench and appointments to Health and Human Services, so forth. They're not looking for a kind of social safety net for the people who are physically infirm or elderly or small children who can't fend for themselves. They really believe in a much more cradle-to-grave redistributionist state. So I think that that's a big part of it, that the left in general has moved. Its center of gravity is not where JFK was in the 1960s. Its center of gravity is much further to the left, and they do not view, as I view, the Great Society programs of Lyndon Johnson and later as being a massive, massive failure that should lead us to rethink things, nor do they view the economic growth that stemmed from the Reagan Revolution as being a good thing. They view that as tossing the poor out. So that's one thing. And then the second thing is that I think that for all their hand-waving about free speech, they're extremely ideological, not only in the way they teach classes, but in the kind of people that they're willing to appoint to professorships. You can see that when you see an occasional odd example like this Ward Churchill thing. How do you get these Native American studies programs that are essentially all ideological, or gender studies programs, or critical race studies, all of whom are appointed?
Would you add to that list? Would you add to that list women's studies?
Yes, women's studies has now been renamed gender studies, and the Middle East centers. In the Middle East centers, you may have noticed that when all the big problems came up in the Middle East during the Arab Spring and later, do you see any experts from universities on any of the serious talk shows and so forth? Not the yell fest, but the real serious shows, the shows that are like your own, Milt. And the answer is no. And why? Because these people are just thoroughly irrelevant. They just study things that don't matter, and nobody takes them seriously.
Well, we've had some people in Middle East study centers, including at the University of Chicago, who've been strongly anti-Israel and indeed have represented the Palestinian, or more broadly, the Arab interest, and possibly have had some serious influence. I have in mind, of course, Rashid Khalidi, who used to be, I think, an adjunct member of your department when he ran the Middle East Study Center. He now does the same as the Edward Said professor in Middle Eastern affairs at Columbia, and who had considerable influence, one assumes, upon a young lawyer around town, Barack Obama, who was a close friend of his and has said as much, including commenting very favorably about the wonderful meals he had at their table. The Middle East study centers are possibly playing a very significant role in influencing some aspects of the American foreign policy establishment, I think. Am I wrong?
I think that their influence is now quite indirect. It's on the education of students and so forth. I just don't think that those people are taken seriously enough. But you can ask your they're taken as seriously as they should be, which is not seriously at all. Nobody would ask Rashid Khalidi for his views about what we should do in the Middle East. He writes one propagandistic anti-U.S., anti-Israel book after another. But one question that your listeners should think about is whether the kind of Middle East center that somebody like Rashid Khalidi dominates at Columbia would ever have somebody with views like me as part of the center or certainly as part of the leadership. I'm not a Middle East expert, so it shouldn't be thinking of me, but think of a Michael Doran or somebody who didn't get tenure at Princeton and moved to Washington, a really senior person. Would they ever take a young Bernard Lewis and make him a tenured professor at Columbia? The answer is there's zero chance of that. Would they take a Martin Kramer? Zero chance of that. Would they take just any of the serious scholars who have views that are different from their own? And I would say that's true in the English department, the anthropology department. There's just a kind of narrowness of views. Political philosophers, they just don't want anybody who looks...
As you know, I share those views of yours completely. And indeed, we've often exchanged mutual resonances on these matters. And I am by now at last emeritized. You're still right there in the middle. And despite your own cynicism about and your own depression, perhaps, about depression would be the wrong word for you, your own disappointment with the way your colleagues are functioning, the way they're thinking, the way they're teaching, you remain one of the most optimistic and one of the most enthusiastic people I know. How do you maintain it? After a while, it really got to me, and I was glad to finally say goodbye to the universe.
I think the key is heavy medication, Milt. Either I'm not paying attention or they're not paying attention to me. I think I'm kind of optimistic by nature, actually.
I'm sure you are.
But I think it's also, Milt, something that I take you as a model of. There's no reason at all to have tenure if you can't say directly what your views are. By the same token, when I teach in a class, I think it is absolutely inappropriate for me to require students to mimic my views. You should be able to get just as good a grade if you think I'm completely wrong on issue X, Y, or Z, if you defend your thoughts well, as if you think I'm right. And I think that we need to get back to that basic notion, which is liberal small l, in the academy. You represented that for many years, and your talk show represents it, Milt.
Maybe we should end by urging all listeners who are also academics to check out the National Association of Scholars.
A wise suggestion, Milton, with some great people who've been associated with that over the years, trying to hold up the right kind of values. Milt, it's a pleasure always, really.
I've just been talking with one of the wisest people I know in academic life. And I thank you so much, Charles, for joining us. See you very, very soon again.
Thank you, Milton. Thank you very much.